So if I just said the name Thunderboat to you with, zero context at all, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Oh, definitely an anime character. If you've spent any time on the internet, you're picturing like a girl with pink hair, arms crossed.
Right. Hostile one minute, but then super sweet the next.
Exactly. That's the trope.
It sounds playful, maybe like a meme or some harmless prank a teenager coded. But the research we're diving into today, well, it shows that playful name is a really clever mask for something much, much worse.
It's the perfect description, really. A wolf in anime cosplay. Because the name sounds cute, but the reality is this is a highly sophisticated and aggressive piece of malware that's just ripping through organizations right now.
We're looking at this really comprehensive report from the cybersecurity firm Technegion, and it details a huge shift in the cybercrime world, focusing on this one group, TA584, and their new tool, Thunderbot. Might sound like a joke, but the numbers are dead serious. We're talking about a group that has just tripled its operational volume.
Tripled. Yeah. And that's not just, a little bit of growth. That's an explosion. It tells you that whatever they're doing, it is working incredibly well.
So our mission today for this deep dive is to get under the hood. We're not here to just say be scared. We want to understand the mechanics. How is this thing using the Ethereum blockchain to hide from law enforcement?
Which is brilliant, by the way.
And how does it trick people into literally hacking themselves?
Yeah.
And why this sudden aggressive expansion into places like Europe and Australia?
It's a fascinating case study. It combines some really manipulative social engineering with some truly bleeding-edge decentralized tech. It's scary, sure, but you also have to admit it's incredibly clever.
Let's start with the people behind it all, this group, TA584. In the whole ecosystem of cybercrime, where do they actually fit? Are they the ones doing the ransomware attacks?
No, not directly. TA584 are what we call initial access brokers, or IABs for short.
We've mentioned IABs before, but it's probably worth a quick refresher. They're the specialists, right?
Yeah, think of them as the expert lock pickers of the digital world. In a heist movie, you've got your muscle, your driver, your safecracker. TA584 is the person who just quietly picks the lock on the back door.
And then just leaves. They don't take anything.
They don't touch a thing. They just prop the door open a crack, and then they go onto a dark web forum and sell the location of that open door to a completely different crew.
To the ransomware gang.
To the ransomware gangs, the data thieves, whoever wants to come in and do the actual smashing and grabbing.
So they're a force multiplier.
Yeah.
They're making it so much easier for everyone else because the hard part getting in is already done for them.
Precisely.
Now, the Technegene report says they've been active since around 2020, but something's changed recently. They've pivoted.
They have. For years, they were using what I'd call like heavy machinery. Tools like Erznif, Xenorat, Cobalt Strike.
These are big, well-known frameworks.
Very well known. And that's the problem. If you're a security team and you see Cobalt Strike activity on your network, alarms go off everywhere. Everyone's been trained for a decade to spot it.
It's too loud. It's
Yeah.
like using a jackhammer to break into a house.
Perfect analogy. So what we're seeing is a pivot to stealth. They've dropped the heavy stuff and picked up tools like Xworm and this new custom malware, Thunderbot. It's lighter, it's faster, and it's much harder to see coming.
And it's not just their tools, it's their targets. The data shows this massive spike in attacks hitting Germany, Europe, Australia. Why move away from the US and the UK?
It's probably a classic business problem, market saturation.
Yeah.
The US and UK are super lucrative, but they're also the most heavily defended. Every security chief in New York or London is on high alert.
So they're just diversifying their portfolio,
Yeah.
going where the competition is a little lower.
Exactly. Germany, Australia. These are wealthy economies with huge targets in manufacturing, finance, tech, but they might not be as prepared for this specific kind of attack vector. It's just a smart business move.
So let's talk about the product they're using to do this, Thunderbot. The report called it malware as a service.
Moz, it almost sounds like a legitimate startup pitch, doesn't it? Like SaaS, software as a service?
It really does. And I think it's important for you listening to understand this means the criminals using the bot probably aren't the ones who wrote the code.
That's the key. The old model of hacker had to be this genius who could do everything, code the virus, manage the servers, run the attack.
Right.
Malware as a service just lowers that barrier to entry to almost zero. The developers, who in this case seem to be Russian speakers based on the analysis, they just build and maintain the platform. They probably have a Telegram channel for customer support.
So a group like TA584 is basically just a subscriber. They pay a monthly fee and get access to this weapon without knowing how to code at all.
It's the democratization of cybercrime.
And the tool itself. It does some really clever things to stay hidden. The report talks about the installation process using Node.js. Now, Node.js is everywhere, isn't it? It runs half the modern web.
It's completely standard for web development. And that's exactly why they use it. It's perfect camouflage. If you're an IT admin, you see a process called Node.js running. You don't even blink. You just assume it's Slack or some internal tool.
So Sunderbot is installing a legitimate copy of Node.js to run its malicious code.
Yes. It's a technique we call living off the land. You use the system's own allowed tools against it. It hides in plain sight.
But the feature that really made me sit up, and this is where this deep dive gets really deep, is this ether hiding technique. This is the blockchain part.
This is, from a technical standpoint, the most brilliant and dangerous part of this whole thing.
Okay, so break this down. Normally, malware needs to phone home to a server to get instructions, right?
Right, a command and control server, or C2, and that's always been the weak link. The malware has an IP address hard-coded in it. Researchers find that IP, they report it, and the server gets taken down.
And then the whole botnet is just dead in the water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Headless. But Sunderbot doesn't have an IP address inside it. Instead, it has code that tells it to go look at the public Ethereum blockchain.
The same ledger that people use for crypto trading.
The very same one. The botnet operators make a tiny transaction on the blockchain. It looks like any other crypto transfer. But buried inside the transaction's data payload is an encrypted string.
And that string is the server address.
Correct. The bot on your machine wakes up, it queries the public blockchain, which you can't block because the entire financial world uses it. No. It finds that transaction, decodes the secret message, and then it knows where its boss is.
That's incredible resilience. To stop it, you basically have to shut down the entire Ethereum network.
Which is impossible. It's decentralized by design. They are using the censorship resistance of Web3 to build a censorship-resistant criminal network.
So they're weaponizing immutability. Once it's on the chain, no one can delete it.
And they can change the server address whenever they want just by sending a new transaction. If a server gets blocked, they post a new IP, every infected machine in the world sees the update on the blockchain and just reroutes itself. It's unbelievably agile.
And once it makes that connection, the report says it uses WebSockets for real-time communication.
Yes, which is another step up. Most malware just checks in periodically. WebSockets opens a persistent two-way connection. It's like a phone call that never hangs up. The hacker types a command and it executes on the victim's machine instantly.
So we've got a bot that hides as a legit process, gets its orders from an unkillable blockchain, and talks in real time. That is a serious piece of kit.
It really is. But here's the irony. All of that amazing tech is completely useless if they can't get it onto your computer in the first place.
And for that, they still have to rely on the oldest trick in the book.
The email. Always the email.
But even here, they seem to have leveled up. They're not just sending obvious spam anymore. The report says they're using compromised real accounts.
And this is key to their success. They aren't faking an email address. They're logging into a real person's dormant account and sending the email from there.
So it passes all the technical checks. It looks legitimate to the spam filters.
Perfectly legitimate. And they use massive services like SendGrid or Amazon SES to send them. So your company's filter sees an email coming from Amazon's own servers from a real account, and it just says, yep, looks good, and lets it right in.
Okay, so the email's in my inbox. I click the link. Usually, this is where a bad file downloads, but there's a filtering step first.
There is. A geofencing check. Before anything loads, their server checks your IP address. Are you in one of their target countries? Germany? Australia?
And it's also checking if I'm a security researcher.
Exactly. If your IP comes from a known security firm or if you're in a country they aren't targeting, the link just breaks. You get a 404 error.
So the researchers think the campaign is over, but it's just actively hiding from them.
Mm-hmm. But if you are the target, an employee in Berlin, let's say, you get sent to the ClickFix page. And this is the most psychologically clever part of the whole attack.
Walk us through this, because when I first read about ClickFix, I just thought, there's no way people fall for this. Mm-hmm. But clearly they do.
They do, in huge numbers. So mm-hmm. You click the link and you get a pop-up that looks like a browser error. It'll say verification failed or something.
And it shows a broken CAPI CHA challenge.
A broken one, yeah. It's designed to make you frustrated. You click it, it fails. You click again, it fails. And just as you're getting annoyed, a little box pops up with instructions on how to fix the problem.
And those instructions tell you to open PowerShell, the Windows command line, and paste in a block of code.
Yes, they are explicitly telling you to copy and paste code into your own terminal.
That just seems like such a massive red flag. Why on earth does that work?
Because it perfectly mimics the look and feel of a real IT support guide. You know, the kind you find on Microsoft's help forums. It makes the user feel like they're the one solving a technical problem.
Oh, that's a dangerous switch.
Yeah.
You're not the victim downloading a virus. You're the hero fixing your browser.
And here's the key. Because you are the one pasting the code, you are bypassing all the security warnings. If a program tried to run that script on its own, Windows would block it. But since the user typed it in, the computer just assumes, well, the admin knows best.
You're literally authorizing your own infection.
You're hacking yourself. And once you hit enter, that script pulls down the Sunderbot payload and loads it straight into your computer's RAM.
Straight into memory.
Right. It's fileless. It never saves a virus.exe file to the hard drive. It just lives in volatile memory.
Which is why traditional antivirus misses it. It's scanning the hard drive for bad files, but there's nothing there to find.
Nothing. It's a ghost. And to complete the illusion, after the malware is running, the script redirects your browser to Google or something harmless. The user just thinks, oh, good, the fix worked, and gets back to their day.
So now the machine is compromised. What's the business model from here? What does the buyer of that access actually get?
Sunderbot has a built-in marketplace. The first thing it does is scan the infected computer and build a profile on it. OS version, internet speed, what kind of graphics card it has.
It's appraising the value of the goods.
Precisely. If it's a powerful gaming PC, it might get sold to a crypto mining gang. If it's a laptop with access to a corporate network, it's sold for a premium to a ransomware group.
The report brings up double extortion here. What does that mean for the victim company?
That's the standard playbook for the top-tier buyers now. A ransomware gang buys access. They don't just encrypt the files right away. First, they spend weeks quietly stealing all the sensitive data.
So even if the company has backups, the hackers still have leverage.
Right. The company says, we're not paying, we'll restore from backup. And the criminals say, fine, then we leak all your customer data and internal emails online. It's a devastating 1-2 punch.
And there was another angle mentioned, SOCKS proxies. What's that about?
That's the lower value side of the business. Even a basic home computer has an IP address, so they turn your machine into a relay point.
So other criminals are routing their illegal traffic through my computer.
Yes. A hacker in country A attacks a bank in country B, but they route the attack through your PC in country C. If law enforcement traces it, the trail leads straight to your front door. You become their digital shield.
It's completely parasitic. So we've painted a pretty bleak picture, but the report does talk about defenses. There was a weird part about a Russian shield. What is that?
That's not a defense for us. It's a defense mechanism for them. It's a self-destruct switch built into the malware.
How does it work?
First thing it does on a new machine is check the system's language settings and keyboard layout. If it sees Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, any language from the Commonwealth of Independent States,
it just shuts down.
It uninstalls itself and aborts the mission. It's a classic don't mess in your own backyard policy. The operators are almost certainly based there, and local authorities often look the other way as long as the targets are foreign. The moment you hack your own countrymen, you get their attention.
So it's pure self-preservation.
Exactly.
Okay, so assuming we're not all going to change our computer's language to Russian, what actually works against this? You said traditional antivirus is basically blind to it.
Signature-based antivirus is yes. You can't look for a bad file if there is no file. The Technigian report really hammers home the need for EDR and threat detection and response.
What's the difference between EDR and antivirus?
Antivirus is like a bouncer at a club with a list of known troublemakers. If your name's not on the list, you get in. EDR is like the security guard who walks around inside the club watching how people behave.
So EDR notices if someone starts a fight, even if they had a valid ID at the door.
Exactly that. EDR looks for behavior. It asks, why is PowerShell suddenly trying to connect to the internet? Or why did Node.js just appear on an accountant's machine? Or why is this computer talking to the Ethereum blockchain?
It's spotting the weird activity, not just the known bad file.
And that's really the only way to catch these living off the land attacks. You have to watch what the software does, not just what it is.
What about the human side of it? The quick fix seems like the real entry point.
That is always the hardest thing to patch. You can't install software to stop a user who is convinced they're fixing a problem. The advice is just absolute. Never, ever run a command from a website or an email to fix something.
Browsers update on their own. They don't need you to run scripts for them.
100%. If you see a screen asking you to paste code to verify yourself, just close the tab. Call IT. It is always a scam. No legitimate website works that way.
It really feels like the old advice of don't click weird attachments is just, it's not enough anymore.
Not even close. We have to be more skeptical of everything. The barrier for criminals is lower, so the volume is higher. And as we've seen with Sundarbot, the sophistication is just off the charts.
It is a lot to take in. We started with this funny anime name and ended up with a global, decentralized, fileless criminal enterprise.
It really just shows you the state of the modern threat landscape. This isn't about lone hackers in basements. It's a service industry. It's slick, it's efficient, and it's using bleeding edge tech.
So what's the one thing you want our listeners to really take away from this whole deep dive?
I think the most provocative idea here is the weaponization of Web3. For years, all we heard was how blockchain was going to liberate us, decentralize the world, uncensored information.
It's a utopian vision.
Right. And now we're seeing that exact same technology being used to build unbreakable criminal infrastructure. If criminals are adopting this decentralized tech faster than defenders can figure out how to police it, we're entering a world where taking down a botnet might become technically impossible.
A pretty sobering thought. The tools of liberation becoming the tools of evasion.
It's the same old cat and mouse game. It's just being played on a much, much more complex board now.
Well, a huge thank you to Technagian for the incredibly detailed report that made this possible. And thank you, as always, for listening. Stay curious, stay skeptical, and maybe think twice before you paste that code. We'll see you in the next deep dive.